And I was yelling to him. I believe I said, wait for me. Wait for me. Don't do it. Wait for me. And I'm running. I mean, I feel like I ran really fast, but I probably really didn't. And maybe I got within 15 to 20 feet of him, and we locked eyes, and he dropped to his knees. And that was it.
Hey guys, check out the 2023 Street Cop Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, Gaylord Convention Center. It's going to be the event of the year. Keynote speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Navy SEAL Jason Redmond, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Marine Corps Special Forces and Leadership Coach Cody Alford, Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff David Clark, and Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's going to be one hell of an event. And on top of that, we have all of our instructors and additional instructors from other companies going to be at the event, giving you everything they know for you to have a successful career and get the results you want to get in the field as a police officer. On top of attending the event, you'll get face-to-face time with every instructor attending the event, and all the keynote speakers will spend time with you. We got special events all week, giveaways, nightlife. It's going to be really, really worth your time, energy, and effort. I promise you, you will not regret it for a second. To register for the conference, check out streetcop.com, click conference, and everything you need will be there on the homepage. If you are looking for a room, just click book a room. The block has been sold out at the Gaylord Opryland Convention Center, but there are many hotels nearby within a walking distance of the event. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity. We will see you there.
You trying to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. We host founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Benito. I have with me today somebody who has an important message for everybody to hear. I think it's a really, really valuable conversation. Strap in. Probably going to get a little emotional, but I think it's worth it. And appreciate you being here. Candace Gorman, tell us about you.
Thank you, Den, for having me.
Well, she dropped the Den right away.
I did. Like I dropped it right out there.
This is great.
Nice and comfortable. My name is Candace Gorman. I've been a police sergeant with Audubon Borough. I'll be entering 21 years of service next week, and that's relieving in itself. I'm married. I have two teenage daughters, first female hired in the town that I police. Definitely a lot of adversities over the past 21 years, to say the very least, I'd say.
So obviously there's a reason that brings us here today.
Sure, yeah.
So maybe we can go into that right away, and we'll circle back around to other things. But
yeah.
I think it's better if you just give your account and maybe tell the story from the date and moving forward of what had occurred on that day.
Well, it started off, it was a Monday day shift, February 8th, 2021. I remember it like, you know, it was yesterday. It was the day after the Super Bowl, and it was really cold outside. It was snow, it was freezing, and it was our first day back from midnight shift. I had a full shift that day, and it started off like any other Monday day shift would. Hey, you know, what are we doing today? We're getting the kids into school, X, Y, Z. And what are we doing for lunch? Right. So in fact, that was one of the last text messages that I had with my crew was prior to this incident taking place was, what are we doing for lunch today? Right. About 2:30 in the afternoon, I had stopped back to police headquarters. I was actually training our new female officer. I was so excited to have her. It's her first day with us.
Jesus.
And, but I was excited to have her because I had only been the only female officer for about 18 years at that point. So I was really excited to have her. I went back and, she's like, I have to use the restroom. And I'm like, okay. And as soon as she walked into the restroom, the phone rang and it was my coworker, Mike, who called. You know, he called, he rang it's our sergeant's phone that we have, that we carry. And he rang the phone and I answered the phone like being me, like, hey, what's up, buddy? Like, what's going on? And his voice was high and it was elevated and he was yelling. And he asked me to get over to his house, that his daughter was sick and he needed me to get to his house. And I said, okay. I said, what's wrong with her? He said, I just need you to get to my house. She's sick. I said, okay. And the last thing he said to me was, are you on your way? And I said, yeah, I'm on my way. You know, I'm coming. and he hung up on me. So instantaneously, I leave our police station and I start driving over to his house. It's funny, I'm like maybe a minute or two out and I start just getting this overwhelming, that pit in the stomach, that bad vibe that came over me. And I knew I wasn't going there for a sick kid. I just had a feeling. So I called my shift and asked them to meet me over there as well. I said, I just have a feeling something's wrong with Mike's kids or Mike's kid. We got to go help him. I don't know what's going on, but we have to get over there. And so I arrived to his house. Once I arrived to his house, his front door was open and I was calling for his wife, who I know very well. And she's a beautiful human being and wonderful person, and been friendly with her over the years. So I'm calling for her. She was upstairs and I went upstairs and I was announcing, hey, it's me. I'm here. Is everybody okay? And sadly enough, she opened the bedroom door and we came face to face. And she actually was still on the phone with him. And I wasn't really sure exactly what that conversation was. But she had handed me a note and said, here. And I'm trying to process like exactly what was going on. I quickly got to the back page to see what I needed to see. And then I remember her, asking her, you know, where's his duty gun? Because instantaneously, that's what I went right to. Where is it? Because just a thought. And she said it was gone.
Where was he?
He was at a different location. He was not in the house. So at that point, I'm calling then to start to get his phone pinged to figure out exactly where he is. You know, the difficult part about this too is like instantly I went to, you know, he has his duty gun and does he have his portable with him? You know, I got to know what I'm dealing with, right? You know, I'm dealing with me, right? We were able to ping his phone in a really, really, really quick amount of time. Probably the quickest ever. And it just happened that way. And I got to him where he was located at a park. I saw his truck. I located his truck. Again, it was freezing out. It was cold. There was only one car parked in the lot. So I saw it right away. And I pulled up to the car. And before I got out of the car, I said a little prayer and just said, okay, this is what you're, it's too late. Do what you have to do and everything's going to be okay. So I get out of the car and obviously I'm in my patrol car and I'm on duty and I get out and I go to tug on his door handle of his car and the car's locked. And then I could feel like, you know, that time that we always talk about, like your blood pressure's up and everything is just like, I could feel that I'm like, oh,
yeah, like adrenaline.
My adrenaline is just pumping, you know, and
I could sick to your stomach feeling.
It's sick. I'm sick and I could feel the pit and I knew it was coming on. I had been in that type of, not that close of a situation, but something similar before. And I felt like I had to look again in the car. So I looked again to make sure I wasn't seeing things. And he wasn't in the car.
Oh, shit.
So I'm looking and I'm like, oh, okay, he's not in the car. And I look off to my left. And this was where this was located is Cooper River Park, which is a very, very big river. It's about four and a half miles around. And I look over to my left and there he is still standing right by down by the river. Probably about 40 to 50 yards away. He's just standing there. So I start running toward him full speed and I was yelling to him. I believe I said, wait for me, don't do it, wait for me. And I'm running. I mean, I feel like I ran really fast, but I probably really didn't. And maybe I got within 15 to 20 feet of him and we locked eyes and he dropped to his knees. And that was it.
What did the phone messages say that his wife was showing you?
It wasn't the phone messages. It was a letter. It was a note.
Okay.
It was a note. I don't recall much of what it said. Again, I just flipped to the back page where it was kind of the final, where he was saying goodbye. I don't really remember anything else.
I don't know how much you want to discuss or how graphic you want to get, but you say he drops to his knees.
He did.
What does he do then?
He sees me coming to him. I mean, he hears me coming and I'm yelling. And he turns, looks at me, we lock eyes. And I thought for a second that I had him. I thought maybe he was going to stop. And at any point, I never saw the weapon, too. I never saw the gun in his hand. I think that's why the shot was so loud for me, because I never saw the gun in his hand. And we lock eyes, and he looks straight ahead again. And, you know, my intent was to grab him and jump on him. I really didn't have a plan. I just knew I was going to do something and not do nothing. We locked eyes, turned away, dropped down to his knees, and he shot himself.
In front of you?
In front of me, yes.
So what's going through your mind after he does that?
I mean, surreal, to say the very least. I really didn't think he was going to do that. I really didn't. And I've known him a long time. I went numb.
Yeah, it's because you feel like everything left your body at that moment.
I think everything left my body. I collapsed. I dropped to my knees after seeing what I saw. My captain came over. He's a bigger guy. Grabbed me by the back. Oh, I really don't remember much. He just grabbed me by the back and just said, stop looking. And he got me out of there as fast as he could.
So he takes the gun out, shoots himself with the gun.
Yeah.
Imagine just falls right in front of you.
He fell right there. That was it.
Were you by yourself for quite a while out there?
No. He and I had that last maybe less than 30 seconds. It seems like an eternity. We had that last 30 seconds together, but my guys were right behind me. I mean, they were seconds. I mean, as they were pulling up, a few of them did hear the shot go off. So they were right behind me.
So did you also like fall to your knees?
I did.
Yeah. And then you're there. And mm-hmm. I guess the next thing you remember is your captain 30 seconds later.
Less than 30. He was right behind me. Yeah. He just grabbed me and he just kept saying, don't look anymore. I just kind of pushed me off, got me off to safety. And then from that moment on, I could remember feeling, it was almost like an outer body experience, because I had all those, I had the loud noise in my head happening. I couldn't hear anybody. So like when people were talking to me, it was almost like they were.
Nothing's processing.
Nothing was processing.
Right.
And everything was completely off. And I didn't really know much in that moment. In those minutes afterward, but I did know that it was how bad it really was. I knew the loss that had just happened.
Was there an attempt to try to provide medical aid at all? I'm not saying from you. I mean, you obviously were in shock. I'm not saying
sure.
You. I'm just trying to paint the picture of what happens now.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, or was it just clear that there's nothing anybody could do?
There was medical aid rendered to him. We were in shock. It's a difficult scenario because you really can't believe what you just saw. He was just alive.
I feel like it's different than even if you change it up and saw somebody in a heated gun exchange being shot or something like that.
I think it is
a
little different,
sure.
Right? Yeah, I think it is. Sure. It's almost like the expectation of what you still for your mind couldn't wrap around it even. Okay, well, this is what the call was. He possibly may harm himself. You still couldn't really piece it together, even though, you know what I mean? It was just like more difficult to process for sure.
So I guess medical aid's rendered and what goes on for you at that point? Where did they, what happened?
I felt drawn to stay there for a little bit of time. I think it was just really difficult to watch the other officers come and everyone came and it's just kind of,
it's pretty fucked.
Helicopters flying, there's ambulance squads, it's just a lot going on.
It's
at
fucked
once.
Up.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. And it never really goes away, you know? And I remember in that moment, I wanted to be with my guys. I didn't want to leave them, but I knew that I needed to go get some care. So at some point, I did head up to the hospital to get checked out.
What did they check you for? Did they treat you for trauma at all?
I didn't have any physical signs of trauma.
Well, that's just it.
They just treated me and sent me home. I don't really feel like I feel like that was just a process that you had to go through. It didn't really do anything for me either way.
It typically often, and I give advice to anybody who's in the field, and I'm actually doing social media posts about this, but anytime that you're involved in something of that caliber, especially if you have to discharge your weapon or you're in a gun battle or something like this is just completely insane. I don't think people realize that the body doesn't have to be inflicted in physical harm to go through intense trauma or have a reaction to it and start going into shock. So my advice to people is don't take it super lightly. I don't care how tough you are. You may want to go get checked out and at least get a Valium in the system before just to calm you down, because you don't know. Much. People really go into – I've seen it, and I could tell you a time when – and I hate to correlate such an awful story to this awful story, but I had a suicide call where it was bad. Mm-hmm. And the kid did – he really hacked himself up in the bathtub. It was a really gory scene. And he had lived with a young guy. He was like 18 or 19 years old. Okay. And we got there, and this young guy was – I mean, he was – he's who found him. And I'm telling you – I'm not trying to compare or contrast, but I can imagine being 18 or 19 and finding your friend living in this house together who had taken his life in such a horrific way. I mean, horrific. I don't even want to go to the details. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we were in there trying to address this dude who had taken his life, I really focused my attention back on the guy who's outside. Never forget him something. And he's like, and I'm like, whoa, 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 we need paramedics over here.
Right.
So we actually put, I went to the car and got the blanket, you know, the one that you opened it up and started wrapping him because he was going into shock. And, you know, some people on the scene were like, I mean, you're calling the paramedics. I'm like, guys, this dude's going into shock and his body is beginning to, I mean, he was like literally started to convulse. And I'm like, this is not good. The psychological trauma of what occurred, you know, eventually he RM80 signed off on scene, but I was significantly concerned. When we talk about this, we have to have compassion for what the mind is able to handle. I mean, you could say we're police officers, but we're human beings. And obviously, some of this stuff is very, very heavy.
Yeah.
So you go back home, I guess, after that? Did you?
Go back home. Tell my family what happened. Really hard for them to wrap their head around it as well. You know, tried to keep it away from the kids as best as I could, but I have my oldest daughter kind of knew something was up. So, you know, I did tell her. And then from that point on, I was home for about 3 months. I was home from work.
When did you first experience your emotions? Because maybe you didn't feel them completely at that time.
I didn't for about 2 weeks. I'm like that with probably everything, but I didn't really feel anything for about 2 weeks. Even his funeral, I didn't feel anything, which was in that same week. I didn't feel anything until about 2 weeks in. And then the reality of everything that took place came to surface for me.
That's interesting.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
I think we typically tell ourselves the story of like who we are.
Yeah.
And that nothing affects us.
Nothing. Right. Yeah.
But I am sitting here and I'm living proof of everybody who thinks they're a tough guy.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those people who I'm fortunate enough where I actually very, very calm, resilient, probably for a lot of reasons, but nobody's bulletproof.
Nobody.
And I hate to use a cliche word for this situation, but it is the truth. And I don't care who you think you are and how much you don't. Once you start packing this stuff down, life is fucked up. It'll hit you from an angle that you never thought you were going to get hit from.
Right.
And that's why we do podcasts like this, to try to understand that, you might think you're okay, but we're going to find out in a second what really happens.
Right. Humbles you real quick.
I think it humbles you and it gives you the ability to come out and do something like you're doing to try to warn people or let them know what you went through. So let's go back to that, to that 2 week mark when you start to have feelings surface. It all starts to come up.
It did.
So tell me about that. When did you first recognize that happening?
It was probably, I guess, about a week in, and I was home, and everything just seemed off. Not going to work right. I'm not in my normal routine. I thought more about our last talks that he and I shared together, our relationship over the years. because we worked together on and off for his 8 years that he was with us.
Wow.
I mean, he was such a great guy to work with. And you really never, I really was reviewing the conversations. Did he say something? But we always say that this sucks. And we say that police work is getting bad. And it was hard for us to adapt to all the new things. And we're the older officers. And we would always have that in common. And we would bitch about shit. I mean, we just did. Did I ever think ever that he felt that way? No. So all those conversations were coming up for me in those 2 weeks. What did I miss? What if, what if, what if? And the what ifs, I mean, to be honest, they never go away. The what ifs are always there. They're there. It's almost 2 years later. The what ifs are still there.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So did you start getting like upset?
I did.
A lot of uncontrolled crying?
No, I mean, I was more withdrawn. I'm more quiet and withdrawn. I'm a very sociable person. So for me not to want to talk with my family or talk with my friends or see my girlfriends or anything like that, that's odd. That's out of character for me personally. Within those 2 weeks, though, I was debriefed by Dr. Jen Kelly. And that's when I started my journey with her, was during those 2 weeks. So I did get into care right away.
What did you learn about what you had been through the work you were doing with Jen Kelly? Mm-hmm. Because I imagine she began to pull back the curtains of what was really going on.
Really?
And start to give you some insight of the trauma that you actually had been through.
Right.
And I think it's interesting when you start working with a therapist or somebody who's a reliable source, you start recognizing all the weird shit you were doing.
That's really weird shit that you were doing.
Yeah. It's outside of your character. I mean, I can
account. And I was doing it for years prior to that event.
Interesting.
Just to say. I uncovered a lot through therapy. So, and that incident, that event for me kind of opened all that. It brought everything to surface. Good way and a bad way.
I mean, it probably, as weird as this sounds, may have saved a lot of important things in your life.
I think
relationships,
absolutely,
purpose. Yeah. As wild as that sounds, is like,
yeah.
I, when you're in the middle of it, you're like, why am I going through this, Lord?
Yeah.
Right? Like, why am I the person experiencing this? And then later on, you're like, oh, because there was a purpose behind it. And like, even showing up here today and doing this, or even me being able to understand what you went through and having compassion or compassion for other people. Yeah. Is where the lesson comes out of it. So you're like, fuck. Like, you ever see these people who lose their families in a car crash or people lose children?
Yeah.
And instead of sitting and living in that trauma for so long, they actually go and become supportive for other people who go through similar shit.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It really is.
And it's a horrible thing that you have to go through that to become one of those people that others can rely on. But yeah, it's really, you know, I've said to myself, like, God, I have to understand that, like, whatever has happened to me has happened so I can help others.
Yeah, for sure.
Do this podcast and have these conversations. But so what kind of things are you guys getting into when you're in your therapy sessions? How often are you going?
Well, the first, right after the incident took place, I obviously saw her twice a week for 3 months. Sometimes even 3 days a week when I really was feeling bad.
It's a lot
for therapy. Made that time for me.
That's great.
The first time I remember her asking me, it's funny, this question always stands out to me. She asked me right after everything happened. She said, well, how do you view your uniform? How do you view it? When you think of your uniform, what do you think of? And I remember like right away, I was like, it's dark. It's evil. It represents darkness and evil. And she said, okay, well, we got our work cut out then. And we started doing exposure therapy. And it was people, places, and things. It was getting back to location. It was doing exercises when I was home for those 3 months, kind of reintegrating myself back into police work. And during that time, her and I uncovered a lot of things. I mean, frankly, I'm out here. I'm on a podcast. I needed therapy 10 years ago, Dan. And it's amazing I survived police work as long as I did up until that point. It really is.
The scary thing is there are so many people that need help. Number one, my job or our job is convincing people that it's okay to go speak with somebody, especially if things are bothering you. Mm-hmm. Even the most minute things begin to pile up and turn into this mountain of bullshit that you have to then start to unpack rather than trying to address things as they're occurring. And people might say, well, I don't need it. I don't need it. I don't need it until it all explodes.
Right.
And then you're a real mess. But the other side of it is, I know there's not enough mental health professionals available.
No.
We've discussed this in the past because mm-hmm. the training required to get licensed as a professional mental health therapist, and then on top of it, to want to go in the field of major trauma and first responders, there's almost nobody. And the people that are available are so overwhelmed. I mean, they're just human beings and nothing's going to change. It's terrible. Just like any profession, and I don't want this to dissuade anybody, but you have to do your homework and find the right person to sit down and speak with. Not mm-hmm. everybody. I mean, the first therapist I talked to, I don't think she was bad.
Right.
Actually, a few therapists I talked to, I don't think they were bad. And then I found somebody who actually heard me and understood me. And this was somebody who is, I think, compassionate to all. Certainly not somebody who's pro-law enforcement, mm-hmm. but certainly not against law enforcement. This is not somebody who wears a blue line shirt, mm-hmm. but has complete compassion mm-hmm. for both sides when she sees something. So she has never imposed my therapist like any kind of thoughts. She actually asked questions about, well, what do you think about these people now carrying guns? And this is just kind of off topic conversations.
Sure.
And she's not like, I don't think, she just needs to understand why I think it's okay to see my perspective. She's, you know, I never thought of it that way. Mm-hmm. I go, well, it's good that you ask questions about that. But when you say exposure therapy, and I've heard of this before from a lot of people we interview who were significantly injured in the line of duty, you know, namely Jesse Hartnett. Mm-hmm. Jesse Hartnett was a Philadelphia police officer. Mm-hmm. He was shot in the line of duty. A lot of people don't know, but he was, you can literally Google his name and watch the video of the man walking up to his car, running up to his police car in Philadelphia and firing 13 rounds into Jesse's car. Remember that video, right?
I do.
You guys are close. You guys are Philly, Jersey.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we're right there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, we were going to go out and film at the location where he was at. And he's like, I can't do it. I can't go back to that spot. I just can't.
Right.
And who am I to try to coerce him into going back? But when you say exposure therapy, did you guys ever end up making it back to the location?
Yes. So the difficult part for me after all this happened was the things, and I think it's important to get out there, is the things that weren't issues for me before became huge issues all of a sudden.
Like what?
So driving past that park, because I live, I kind of can't pass it because where I live and going to the grocery store, going to the gym and doing the things that I do, I have to pass that all the time. I never took a thought of it before. I never found it difficult to put my uniform on again. I would never think that I would have any of these issues, and yet they all became really hard for me. So our first part of the therapy exposure was to put my uniform shirt back on, because I had put it in a closet and shut the door. And for me, that's was the safest place for all the uniforms to be after that happened. So I started to put it back on again and feel it. And she wanted me to listen to my radio. So that was part of the exposure. On my off days, she wanted me to drive into town, which I found to be really hard because he lives in town. His family lives in town. His kids go to school in town. And there's just so many triggers there. And they're still there. I mean, they don't really go away.
I'm learning stuff about myself because the town that I grew up in, I avoid like the plague. And now that you're saying this, I'm like,
yeah, you can't.
Oh, Den's going to have a fucking ride tonight.
Right.
And do some unpacking as to.
Yeah. She wanted me to go back and hit you. She's like, you have two options, Candace. Either you can stay home and hide from it, and you can sail off into the sunset and let it go, or you can go back and face it. And it just didn't sit well with me. It wasn't okay for me. I had to go back to face it.
When did you ultimately decide that you were going to return to work, and why?
It was about 2 months in, and I was still home, and my oldest daughter said to me, I guess I'm raising them really well, which I'm happy.
Sure.
She said, Mom, are you going to go back to work? Are you still upset and things? And I said, yeah, I'm really upset. I don't know if I'm going to go back to work. Mom, you got to go back. You're not okay with this. And my husband, the same. He said, I know you too well, Ken. You can't live in this. You're not okay with this. And the truth of the matter is, I wasn't okay with ending it like that. It just didn't work for me.
Right.
It's not okay.
Yeah.
You know, he, and I say this, And I say this with, and there's not a bit of anger when I say this. It's nothing but love that I feel, and I will always care for my coworker. But he took a lot from me that day, but he doesn't get to take it all. That's where I stand with that. You don't get it all. I have my fights to be here. I've had things I've had to overcome, other issues, other things, pregnancies, you know, working with all men, the whole thing. I've done it. This isn't what's going to take me out. And that's kind of where my stop point was.
You really try to think about the pain somebody must be in to make a decision to take their life. I mean, it's wild, right? Like, and unfortunately enough, I mean, my hand to God, I've never even had a thought like that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean I can't understand where somebody's at. And I know people that have taken their lives. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to express that to their families. Like, I can't even imagine how bad it's got to be. But, you know, one of the questions I had for you was, and we try to emphasize this because I've spent time with mental health professionals on, like, you know, what are some ways that we can try to prevent and send messages out from people taking their own lives? And I think people really need to acknowledge that if these thoughts are in your brain, mm-hmm. one, life is a precious thing. You don't have to take that route. You're going to miss so much. But two, listen to the impact you've caused on people that you've loved. It's a very selfish thing, especially when there's options. And I mean that in a very compassionate way. Sometimes you have to have a little tough love to get the message through. But I mean, Candace was essentially his coworker, and still now he has altered her life. So you've taken your pain and in some weird way, selfishly put it on somebody else. I'm not saying go and do it by yourself. I'm saying don't forget about after you're gone, what your family must deal with, right. What your friends must deal with the kind of trauma that they're going to be put through. He has kids.
Three
children mm-hmm. who now don't have a father. No matter what happens, your kids will not have a father or a mother or a brother or a sister. And it's wrecking everybody else's lives. So while you're in pain to try to find the deep why or how to get help might be the built on the back of what you're going to do to other people.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a mental health professional. I'm just trying to put the message out there to get people to understand, like, this is real. It's not made up.
Right.
I didn't conjure that up just now. I think it's important to know that. What else would you say to somebody that was thinking about committing suicide?
I think the biggest thing that I think to get it to a preventative state, and I'm not just saying the suicide, it's even like getting preventative treatment before something happens, right? Make that part of your, like we work out, we do our physical health, right? We're doing that. But are you maintaining your mental health? So I feel, and through the therapy that I'm still in, I'm going to continue to be in for the duration of my police career because I still need that, will be, you know, more for preventative treatment. Get to it before it gets to those point where you're having suicidal thoughts, right? Don't let it add up, right? It's all those little things that are chipping away at you after all those years, right? So then when the big thing happens, the top blows. Right. So instead of we're doing something to prevent those issues from happening, you know, get yourself in the care, get the therapy you need, you know, and maybe just maybe it would help if you're in that place to have those suicidal thoughts. Or and a lot of the time in our line of work, it's, you know, there is no restoration for after when an officer something happens, whether they get a 450 or they get into a domestic or they get charged. There is nothing for them. There's nothing. Fix it before it gets to that point. And therapy is the key of doing it. I would never, ever, ever, ever go on without having therapy. And I just don't. And it's just like you're just sitting there and all you're doing is talking. So even if you just get one thought out, that's one thing that you don't have stuffed inside of you, right? Right? We do this police career, right? You're doing it for 20 years. Well, 10 years of it, if you didn't talk about it, it's just nothing but built up bullshit for 10 years. So then when something big happens in your life, personal, divorce, finances, whatever the case may be, the lid blows and there is nothing to fix it yet until it gets to that point. And I would just hope that maybe me coming on here is some motivation, if one person just cares for themselves, just one, before it gets to the point of no return, really.
You know, and therapy is a non-judgmental environment. I think everybody has a fear of being judged. And to be honest with you,
especially us.
Oh, well, sure. I think human beings in general, but a lot of times we're judged by the people that are closest to us.
Yeah.
Spouses, I wouldn't say children, but I would say parents, family members, coworkers. It's very easy to judge.
Yeah.
When you meet somebody who is non-judgmental and accepts you for who you are, deformities or whatever it may be, there's just a general appreciation when you know somebody's not seeing you in a way that most people see you in a way. And unfortunately, when something does occur and you don't get to tell your side of it, judgment's clear. And people live in a very – it's very hard to find people who do not live in a place where they're mentally unwell. So you see it on the internet constantly. Anything you do is – you can anticipate judgment coming your way.
Sure.
We literally just did a few TikTok videos that'll go on other platforms as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm literally saying in the video, hey, I know that some of you are going to comment your tactic, your style, your dynamic. I don't care. I want you to know that. I know that I'm going to be judged for this. But what I'm saying here is I care enough to deal with the judgment, knowing it's coming,
right,
because I care enough about your personal safety. So when I'm telling you why I would do it the way that I'm proclaiming to do it, it is not your job to say you wouldn't do it that way. It is just your job to say, I never thought of it like that. I don't agree with it, and I'm just going to do my thing. So, you know, we live in a world where even some of your best friends will cast judgment. And especially as you move on in life and progress, in any way, shape, or form, it's a hard thing to acknowledge that some people are just not going to be along for the ride with you. And you can't depend on anybody but yourself.
No.
And that's the crappy thing.
You have to advocate for yourself.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
We see a common thing as we're going back into, and we flip and flop, not purposely, just on the variation of guests that we get on this podcast, but mental health has been brought up quite a bit. Probably discuss it half the time. But we have seen in the past, people we've spoken with, people I've talked to in person who have said to me, like, hey, I didn't kill myself because of you, and I want you to know that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, holy shit. So I had to reach out to mental health professionals, and I'm like, you know, what am I supposed to say? Obviously, I'm wearing this whole different hat now where I think people are understanding of how compassionate I am, but I am not trained. But I always ask questions. I'm like, hey, can you tell me about your predisposed mental health before this moment where you were almost going to do it? And they're like, yeah, like I was diagnosed with depression and then came into law enforcement and circumvented the system of the psychological exam. And I don't blame you. I don't blame you for circumventing the system because you wanted this job so bad. But what I'm saying is, even if you have done that, take account for you're coming up and showing up into this profession with something different than other people don't have. Mm-hmm. And you are different than other people, and that's okay. But don't ignore this predisposition to depression if you're feeling it. High anxiety is another one. Right. It seems like people that I've spoken with on these accounts where they came up to me and said face-to-face or called or message or whatever they wanted to do, all had similar things in common. But also for the people who don't experience that stuff typically, don't think that you're bulletproof from that either, because I mean, in the past year, for the first time in my life, I experienced panic attacks. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how the fuck do I have panic attacks at 40 years old? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at 40, I'm saying to myself, like, I'm literally having panic attacks. And I'm telling my therapist, I'm like, I've never had them before in my life. She's like, well, you're dealing with some real fucked up shit.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm going to call it like it is. You were really handed some tough roads to walk down right now. And, you know, what I say to people who are going through tough stuff is, you know, just one foot in front of the other every single day. I know it seems like it's not going to end, but it is true. And all these sayings out there exist for a reason, because they are true.
They are.
What do you think was done right or done wrong after that incident occurred on you? Or I know that you guys have a very strong bond in your administration there, but where do you think we are doing things right, or where do you think we're failing as a profession when it comes to stuff like this?
I think we could start with educating ourselves better. I know a lot of departments now are pushing our wellness policies.
Getting there. We're starting.
We're starting. It's going to be a long road.
Sure it is. You know why? Because you got to get the right people.
Got to get people and make sure it's done the right way. And I think we're really far off of that. although I think if, you know, we could educate ourselves more, I mean, in any sort of situation like that.
I know recently of a significantly mass casualty incident that occurred not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And obviously, again, I wear this hat now as a law enforcement thought leader. Maybe somebody that's a shoulder to cry on and all these different hats that I wear. But overall, we have national notoriety as a police training company. And I spoke to some folks who went to a very significant incident recently. Mm-hmm. And I was literally flabbergasted to find out that there was no intervention after a mass casualty incident. And they were basically told, like, we'll see you to work tomorrow. Hop in your patrol car. What are you fucking doing? Like, yeah. You get back to work. Right. But what an embarrassment to go to some kind of mass casualty thing and then be told, we'll see you at work on Friday. Right. Do I get to speak to anybody? Nah, we'll figure it out. But you're gonna be at work because we're shorthanded and you got to come to work and you're gonna go back to, like, you're literally gonna start answering calls again after seeing people slaughtered. But the human brain's not meant for that. And just because you weren't there doesn't mean you can't have compassion for what that person must have seen. And my heart broke. I don't have answers. I'm not a billionaire. I can't retire you right now. My heart broke. And I really said to that, or a few people, would you like me to make this public? And, you know, they have a career to think about.
Right. Yeah.
And let's face facts. You can make something public and it's one thing one day and a week later, we've all forgotten about it. No different than anything else.
Right.
All these significant things that occur, they just kind of wash away over time. So I don't think that would have been the solution, but maybe it's a platform like this. People move up through their career to think about when somebody goes through something traumatic, even though you might not see it that way, they do.
Mm-hmm.
So stop trying to compare yourself to other people and really have that compassion to say, how would I feel if I was in their shoes? You know, people responding to this mass casualty incident, like letting their parents know that they might not see them again while they were responding, getting ready to go in and battle somebody. And it's like, you good? Cool. There's like 8 calls pending, right? I know you just saw like 11 slaughtered human beings, but you're good to go back on the road. Wild shit. For me, I'd be like, you're good for months, right? Like let's don't worry about it. You're on administrative leave from now till forever. We'll figure it out. Like, we're going to get you the help you need and you can make a decision later on if you want to come back. That's up to you. So when we say we got to do better, it's absurd. And people don't realize what cops have to go through. And, listen, a lot of people go through a lot of things. Our niche is the police field, the first responders. Did Mike have any history of mental illness, you know?
Not that I know of.
His wife, did his wife say anything about it? Did anybody know anything about it?
No, he comes from most of his family's law enforcement.
Wow.
So.
How do you hide it so well?
I don't know.
Are we trained not to, you know, we're not trained to see it? You're not even putting thought into it?
You spend 40 hours a weekend. Like we would spend a whole work weekend together.
Yeah.
And I talked for 12 hours, right? Like it's a 12-hour shift. So I would talk and he was quiet. I mean, he was quiet. He was quiet and he was calm and he was really funny. He was a really funny dude, actually. But no, I don't think that they knew. And I think if they did know, they would have done their best to intervene. I mean, shit, I wish he said something to me.
People are afraid of the judgment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Three kids.
And I'm the type that I would never make him feel like, it's not like I'm like this, you know, oh, like eat my chest and like, this is what we're going to do. You know, we're going to go out and like take on the world. Like he and I pretty much had the same time on, you know, we were just trying to get through the shift. I would have never judged him. I hope he would know that. But
I think there has to be maybe some intervention early by administrations to say, like, look, if you're thinking like this, we're promising you, we're actually going to put in your contract. There'll be no judgment when you come back.
Right.
Yeah. Right? And we'll make sure of it. But again, this comes back to that leadership and how much we've failed everybody of trusting your administration. How much do you trust your bosses?
Right.
And if you've given them no reason to trust you up to now,
well, they're not going to
You're not going to start now when you're thinking about suicide,
right.
You know?
Right.
Maybe leaving the profession might be a better thing if the profession is killing you. It's wild.
It is.
Not too long ago, I think like 3 Chicago police officers, and I hate to misquote, this could have been 5, in one weekend killed themselves. 3 Chicago. So it's just insane.
I can't imagine.
But we know how they treat their people there. It's clear as day.
Of course.
There's no secret to it.
Nope.
We hear from those guys constantly, and they're like, it is ridiculous to try to do police work here.
Right.
It's a real mess.
Yeah.
And I guess we're all trying to do our job and extra effort into trying to unmess this stuff. So I guess this is a good lead into, what are you doing now? I see you have a pamphlet with you, some stickers.
I do.
Tell me about what the purpose of today is, outside of telling the story.
Since I've been in therapy, actually, Dr. Kelly had wanted me to go to these resiliencies and start speaking. She endorsed it. I brought the idea to her and she said, I think you should do it. I think you should get your message out there and put therapy out there and, you know, that you're actively still working and you are still receiving therapy, right? Because that's the big thing. Like, oh, you can't work and have therapy. Maybe that's the stigma some people may think still. But I'm here to say that I'm doing it. And, you know, I bring here some positive messages about therapy, and you don't have to be as public as I am about it. You know, you can do your own thing and keep it quiet. I bring here a foundation that Mike's family made in honor of Mike. It's on Instagram. It's the MRM Foundation, and they built it in his name, and it goes to first responders in our area and some local things. So it's some really good stuff. And if you guys could check it out, that would be great for sure.
How's his family doing?
I would like to say that they're good, but I really don't know. They're good, wonderful, wonderful, amazing people. And they've started this foundation. And I think about his wife and three kids all the time. I mean, we see them in town all the time.
How old are his kids?
They're young. Maybe the oldest might be like 12.
Oh, that's young.
Yeah,
very traumatic.
They're young, and that's one thing I wish. I wish I would have got out his kids' names, but that's my biggest regret. I wish I would have, like, maybe that would have snapped them out of it, but it didn't happen.
I'm sure your therapist told you can't carry on that kind of burden. Yeah. It's like a bag of rocks.
Yeah, it's like a heavy bag.
Oof.
Yeah, and the bag's still there. It's just some days I have to empty it. I have to continue to empty it.
It wasn't your fault.
No.
And I think you did a really good job of what you had to do. And I think anybody could have been put in the predicament. And I'm going to guess and say that there's nothing anybody could have said that would have stopped his intent. I just don't think, not in 30, 45 seconds. Because, again, I'm not a professional, but I think sometimes people are, there's a cry for help. And I think that other times there are people who are steadfast in intent on carrying out their mission, no matter what. They've made the decision before you got there.
Sure.
We've had it happen. I've watched it happen. I've watched dispatchers try to talk people out of it who have said, literally, just send the cops here. I just don't want my kids finding me. And like, we're calm and cool, collected over the phone. And as soon as we pulled up, you heard the shot.
Yeah.
So I don't know why he chose you. But I maybe in some weird way, he wanted it to be you because he felt close to you.
I do. I do believe that.
And I don't think he meant to.
No, I don't think I was supposed to be there. I firmly don't believe that was in the plan. I think I was supposed to be with his wife.
You think you got him just too early, maybe?
I think I did. Yeah. But I was supposed to be there. And I look at it at somewhat, I try to take a positive from it where he wasn't alone.
Because if it had to be somebody, it had to be you. And you'll find that one day.
And I think so. And I think it was better it was someone like me. It wasn't maybe a new officer that would have changed the trajectory of their career forever. I think if anyone was supposed to take it that day, it was supposed to be me. I do. And I miss him. And if he were here today, I wish he would have held on. I wish he would have waited held on a little bit longer. You know, people care about you. He was enough, you know, and I wish I knew.
Where do you think you are in this stages of grief? Have you reached acceptance yet?
I have. I have come to acceptance.
It's tough.
It's
a long road to acceptance.
It's really tough. And again, we'll be coming up on 2 years, and there's still days that I'm set back.
Well, you'll always have that. Always come back.
And they don't really go away. But I know through therapy and the tools that I have in my toolbox now is the days to pull back, right? Days not to be seen, the days to stay home, the days to lay low.
Yeah. They bite you in the ass,
and it's hard to get back up again to go back and do that. And there are still days that it comes and goes. I mean, it's always going to be there, and that's what I've learned in therapy. It's always going to be there, but now I have things to combat it.
And at least you know what it is now.
I know what it is now, but prior up into Mike's incident, there was a lot of shit that I didn't deal with. It was the domestics over the years. It's babies, it's elderly people, it's It's the simple, it's even the neighbor complaints, right? They start to build up, and I never really had a proper release of that. You know, now I do. Now I do. And I'm really thankful. Maybe this was the journey. Maybe it was to come here. Maybe it was to get the message out there. Maybe, just maybe.
I think it'll continue to come to light of why you were put through this. And I don't want to call it a blessing in disguise, because I don't think there's anything blessing about a situation like this. But we also have to see it as to why it happened.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody can measure. People shouldn't be measuring your trauma versus my trauma. Trauma's trauma.
Trauma's trauma.
And everybody processes trauma a little differently.
Right. Everyone has a different threshold, right?
I think everybody just experiences different situations differently, where you don't know how invested people are in this or that, and then it all falls apart, or something happens where a family member may not have even been sudden, but over the course of time, you've lost them through some kind of terminal illness. It's watching that person leave us, or there's going to be so many things, losing your job, losing your house.
Mm-hmm.
Everything just affects people differently. And you're talking to a guy who is one of the most resilient people you ever meet in your life, and who learned a lot about himself in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thankful that I had gone through what I had gone through, but I mean, I was rocky in round 14. I mean, I was getting my fucking teeth kicked in.
Yeah.
I guess I had built up 2022 to be such a significantly difficult year that, and believed in my mind that 23 be the threshold of like things would start to happen. And you know, listen, I think you can't put a timeline on things. I think you just have to keep showing up. And good things and bad things are going to happen in life. That's just how it is. And even in 23 thus far, some real cool stuff, but we've had some crap happen already, and that's just part of it. Like, there's not going to be some timeline of where you can account for when things are going to be great, when things aren't.
Right.
You just got to be ready for life. And I think that I'm fortunate enough to have spent a lot of time in self-development over the past 7 to 8 years, that I was prepared to understand a lot of what was going on and what was happening. So I want to implore people to spend time in self-development, you know, and really try to get, I think some of the best stuff that's coming out of the internet now is like these video clips of resiliency and mindset and life. Mm-hmm. Really good shit. Like, really, it's really good to hear from other people.
It is. It really is. And every day you have a battle, no matter what it is. Every day we all have something we have to overcome.
Just how you see it.
It's just how your mindset is. And you have to, you know, again, physical, take care of yourself, mentally taking care of yourself.
Well, that'll help you.
You can overcome with it. You can do it. Anyone can do it. I'm not the first person to do it. I'm not the last person to do it.
Yeah, that'll help you. I mean, it's no question about it. That part of your system will be a lot more resilient if you're more correct with your diet and exercise.
Absolutely.
And physical, mental well-being.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it. It has, and it's proven, I think it's science, that it has complete correlation to if you have to experience something like this. But I just want to warn people that if you start feeling the impact of a significant incident in your life, or life is hurting you, mm-hmm. just that step. Everybody says the same thing. Just have to make that first phone call. It gets the ball rolling. I don't know what it is. It's that first phone call. And there are hotlines like Cop to Cop. Do you have the number for Cop to Cop? Do you know it?
I don't, but I have it in this.
If you Google Cop to Cop on your phone, everybody has a smartphone.
Sure.
But if you actually internet search Cop to Cop, the phone number comes up, and those are non-judgmental trained counselors for at least a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people who do that. They're volunteers. And I think it's a good place to start. Do we miss anything before we wrap this up?
I don't think so. I just want to thank you for having me.
No, I appreciate
you
coming in.
It's
message is important.
Thank you. It is. It really is.
All right, guys. So hopefully everybody took some value out of this podcast episode, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.